Big edition of The Breakfast Club. It's great to have your company. If you missed any of the good stuff, here's a snippet of what we did.
I reckon it was the sort of weekend that Adam White would have just been sitting there on the couch watching from about 7 a.m. in the morning till 3 a.m. the next morning. Couple of hours sleep and he backed it up again. Good morning, Whitey.
But it's been a little bit like that. It really has been. Just so excited. So many things happen on the weekend. Yeah, so many things of real significance. And obviously the final round of the US Open's playing out as we're on air today. So there's a real opportunity for someone to make a name for themselves. The last six major golf championships have been won by first-time winners.
That's six.
Yeah, so another one's got a great opportunity today to add to that list and make a name for himself, because Sergio Garcia is the only one that might be able to make a bit of a charge. He's six back. The wind is up. So you never know, but I kind of think he's probably too far back. So we have that to talk about. And the cricket last night was amazing. Absolutely amazing. Pakistan versus India. You don't get any bigger than that.
No.
I know we've got the Ashes, and that's huge as well, but a Champions Trophy final involving arch rivals India and Pakistan. Pakistan have been, I don't know what you call them, a roller coaster ride over the last 20 years. Clinical in the way that they disposed of England in the semi-finals, and they go out and do it to India in the final, making 340 and bowling them out for 170.
It was a smacking, wasn't it?
Yeah, so there's that, and there's obviously the footy, and I know we've got to introduce our next guest, but you know what I did on Saturday, which I'm really happy I did?
What did you do, which you're really happy about you doing?
I went and took my two boys to watch Kerry Grammer take on Haileybury College.
Oh!
A battle of...
That was for the title, wasn't
it? Yeah, the two undefeated teams in APS footy. Out at Kerry Boleyn, and it was a brilliant game of schoolboy football. I was blown away by the standard. Now, they say that there could be as many as 10 players that could get drafted from that game,
right.
Mainly from Haileybury, but also a few from Kerry over the next 2 years, because they're 10, 11, and 12 players. Gee, it was good footy. And it had school spirit as well, which just added another layer to it. Haileybury won by 9 points. They're out by 5 goals. And after Kerry had a slow start, and Kerry got within 3 points with about 5 minutes to go, it was a really good game of footy.
The Matthew Lloyd led Haileybarians in the APS competition this year. Jimmy Bartel hasn't coached anyone just yet, but I'm sure it'll happen down the line. Good morning to you, Jim.
Morning, Half. I'm not sure whether I'm mad enough to coach like yourself. You went down the coaching path.
It's good fun. It is good fun. You would love it.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
You would.
Not sure, but...
It's great fun. Schoolboy, I've done the schoolboy thing. I'd like to do that, I reckon.
I tell you, Lloydie really enjoys it, and he's really good at it. So
they've got the two King boys there, though.
They both play.
Six, seven.
Lloydie reckons could be going sort of top five
year 11.
Yeah.
And they look like they're 25-year-olds.
Big key position.
That's unfair.
Yeah, one of them kicked 4 goals and... Wouldn't say he was the difference, but he was certainly very good for them.
Were you one of those kids half a school footy? You look 25.
Yep, I was this big at 14.
I look genuine.
Well, height wise, anyway,
I look genuinely my age. I was skinny.
No, I was the early mature man child type activity. That was me. So I was good at the schoolboy game. I could deal with those ones.
You just backed into contest, didn't you?
Courageously, because I knew I'd hurt them. that's good. So Haileybury are champions, APS champions.
Oh, well, they've still got to win one of their last two. So we've got school holidays coming up and they've got a bye, but they'd only need to win one of their last two to win it.
Did the dude from St Kilda play for Haileybury on the weekend? What was his name?
He didn't play. I know the one you're talking about. Is it Scrimshaw?
No,
I can't remember.
Oh, goodness.
I know the one you mean.
I've forgotten his name. I'll get back to that shortly.
But Lou Richard's grandson played for Kerry. He's a good player. Very good player.
What's his surname?
Richards.
Oh, he's a Richards?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, he was very good.
Righto. Nice work. But how's your weekend, Jim?
Yeah, it was good. I was with, same lines as Waddy. I enjoyed watching the cricket last night. Muhammad Amir, that spell of opening bowling was fantastic. When you watch a left armer who's genuine quick and the ball moving, it's great to watch. And I guess if you were, cricket, do they have a forward scout or anything like that? If you're for the Aussies, we have left arm quicks, you'd watch the line and length that Amir was bowling. I know it was to the Indians, but he never gave him a ball to jump onto the front foot, but he wasn't too short where they played him easy off the back. He had Kohli, who by far and away has been the best one-day batsman for how many years, Whitey? Had him twice in two balls. Nick, drop catch. That was typical Pakistan, wasn't it? And then got him the very next ball. It was great fast bowling at its best.
I think what happens in cricket, and this happens in World Cup finals, it happens in Champions Trophy finals, it certainly happens in club cricket. Bowlers win your finals. Batsmen can set up finals, but bowlers win your finals. And it was set up by the Fakhar, who was playing just his fourth one-day international.
That's going to get people unstuck.
Yes,
in
I know.
He's the most talented Fakhar I know.
Yeah, that's
did
right.
you know that? It's the only one I know, but he's the most talented by a mile.
Yeah, this is very 12th man life.
I know, so,
it's very 12th man life, isn't it?
So many paths we could go down. But he's just talented. In his fourth one-day international to score 100... In a Champions Trophy final against India, that's going to get one of the most watched games of sport in the history of the world.
But it's funny how he did it. He was just like swatting. There was a whole lot of swatting going on from my man Fakhar.
I wouldn't say that. I won't say.
As technical as
no, he wasn't. And he got dismissed on a no ball. And he had a good eye and he hit the ball well and away he went.
They didn't pick him for the first game, did they?
No,
they brought him in through the tournament. I think he got a 50 as well. He scored 250 runs in four games in the Champions. But and even typical, you sort of watch Pakistan, you go, what move are they going to pull next? And Amir had 3 for 16 off six in the final. You think, surely he gets bowled out. Nah, rotate someone else in. But they won by 180 runs. That's a pantsing.
That's an absolute pantsing. Hasan Ali was the bowler of the tournament, or the player of the tournament for Pakistan. He had 8 overs and he got 6 overs, 3 for 19 last night in the final as well. And that's what Flem was talking about that last week, wasn't he? The fact that they found some real good quick bowlers. And we know that Mohammad Amir has been certainly a very talented young player for many, many years, obviously with that hiatus through the last five. But Hasan Ali's come from the clouds to be this really dominant force.
Well, just for people, he bowled the world's biggest no ball. Deliberate no ball.
Yes, well, he had some issues back home.
See, think of even back to last summer, Wahab Riaz, who he played really well in the World Cup last time, and then he bowled really quickly and was almost their spearhead of the attack in the summer just gone. He can't get a game at the moment, and he can bowl 150.
Yeah.
So Hasan Ali,
he's aggressive too.
Yeah, and Hasan Ali is a little bit more disciplined with the way he bowls and changes his pace. That was a really impressive display from Pakistan. Their bowling particularly. I mean, England thought they just had to turn up and they'd beat them in the semi-final. And just the way they bowled to be able to contain them to such a low score over 50 overs and then do it again in the final. It's amazing.
And it was the first time I think Pakistan had beaten India in a big tournament since 2009.
Yeah.
So it's been a long time. And they're the 8th ranked team. Defeating the first ranked team.
And a bit of a comeback of sorts, I guess, for Mickey Arthur, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah,
he's done the cricket circles and he's found a winning team there in Pakistan.
See, a few things happened in the cricket. We've got plenty of footy to talk about and we'll do that through the morning. But, just Australia, it's very easy to say, oh, they don't care about it because they got knocked out of it. But that's obviously a trophy they'd like to win because it's the second only to the World Cup when it comes to one-day cricket. But the selection half of the the Bangladesh test squad happened.
Yes.
Despite the fact there's no certainty that tour will go ahead for a variety of reasons, including the issues with Cricket Australia at the moment. But Steve O'Keefe not selected. So you think, okay, well, John Holland will get that second spinning position, 50 shield wickets last summer. Obviously he would go. Not selected. And then in the press release, not even a word on him from Trevor Holmes.
Not a mention.
Has Trevor
forgotten he's here?
So who was the replacement then for O'Keefe?
Well, they're going with Ash Nagar.
Yep.
Because they think they can see him as a bowling all-rounder more than a specialist spinner.
We've been looking for an all-rounder since Freddie Flintoff tore us apart, haven't we?
Yep, absolutely.
When that series, Ash's series, we've been looking for the almost like-for-like replacement.
Yep.
Do we have to have an all-rounder?
No, we don't.
If you haven't got a Freddie Flintoff or a Jacques Kallis, I don't think you can manufacture one. You pick batsmen or bowlers on their specialty and you pick them to play the roles that they need to play for the team as opposed to hedging your bets and trying to get something out of them in both disciplines. You pick specialists and let that do the talking.
All-rounder is a luxury. If you're lucky enough to have one that can fulfil both roles, well, that's terrific. But if you don't, you don't pick them. But it really agitated me that on the weekend because it just is another example of not so much Cricket Australia, but the selectors just showing absolutely scant regard for Sheffield Shield cricket. And we're told that Sheffield Shield cricket is the best standard of domestic cricket in the world, yet they don't pick players based on the performances in that level of cricket. It's just, I just don't understand what sort of message that's going to send.
Well,
it's crazy.
But it's a departure from recent policy as well, because in the last, was it 2 years ago, when they named Adam Voges got his first look in the test team because of his Shield performances with weight of runs. And it was even, I think it was Farwin Ahmed was added to a squad at one stage because of the way he bowled through a Sheffield Shield summer. So they have shown an inclination to get those players into test squads and give them reward for effort. But all of a sudden they've backtracked from that as well, which doesn't make any sense.
Last summer was odd with a lot of their selections, and you know, we spent a lot of the summer talking about that. But there's this feeling that, oh, they've got to search for the next star of test cricket. Well, that's absolute garbage, because those players find you, and they find you by playing really well in Shield cricket, and then they get rewarded handsomely by being able to play for Australia. And they've got real confidence and a foundation behind them from what they've done at that level. And it's the same with across all sports. You perform well at the level below, you then subsequently get rewarded for your hard work and for your performances. It's as simple as that.
The inclusion of, or the reintroduction of, Hilton Cartwright ahead of Marcus Stoinis, is that the...
No, I'm very happy with that, because Hilton Cartwright, I was very unhappy when he was initially selected to play for Australia. But his runs after Christmas for WA, his figures are enormous. And so he thoroughly deserves his spot in the team. What annoys me is when they say, oh yeah, he's a good player, hits the ball hard. I couldn't care less how hard he hits the ball. It's how many runs he makes. And he's made a lot of runs, and I'm very comfortable with him being selected.
I'll talk more on that through the morning. Paul's in Ringwood on the open line, 1-300-652-927. Good morning, Paul.
Yeah, good morning. Look, just on the effect of football this year and what it's had on me as a Carlton supporter, when our coach said it was about the process and not about winning and losing, I thought to myself, ho-hum, ho-hum, here we go. But actually, looking at the enthusiasm of the younger players like Silvani and Fisher and Williamson, it's really rubbing off on senior players. And Bryce Gibbs had 10 tackles, which is unusual for him and totally unknown. And guys like Thomas and Jones are really, you know, stepping up better than ever. So it is about the process.
I couldn't agree anymore, Paul. You can see their whole club's bought into what Brendan Bolton's trying to build there. And you see as a team unit, they're completely committed to it. They're building their game for defence first. Off their strengths, which is obviously the players in their back six and through their midfield. And I think over the next 18 months, we'll see them add some more attacking flair, because they've won some great games. They've won them in the style that suits them, which is, you know, tight, close encounters where 70, 80 points is tended to score kicked. But I reckon over the next 18 months, we'll see Carlton go forward a little bit more. But I agree, the young players do exactly what Brendan Bolton asks, and he just keeps playing them when they do it. If they don't, they go back and they bring in the next player. And I think that's having a great effect, as you said, on the senior players, because they understand that it's almost like Brendan Bolton's got a... he judges them all equally. Yep. As long as you're doing the right thing and playing the Brendan Bolton way, he's very happy to go with you.
They were terrific, the Blues, on Saturday night. Yeah. We'll talk more about it after 7 o'clock with Steve-O, but they were terrific. That's first half.
A bit of emotional attachment that I'm sort of sensing from you, the way you were.
This is Carlton's very own.
Very proud, I'm
a past great. There's no doubt about that. I'm a past great. So that's sort of maybe underlying my sentiment. But no, they were brilliant. The way they set that game up, from the very first minute, you knew that it was going to be a really difficult game for the Gold Coast. And Carlton just made it so uncomfortable for them that they couldn't deal with it in the first half. They did, to their credit, they rallied and got back in front in the last quarter. And had that injury not happened to Michael Barlow, I think they probably would have won the Gold Coast. But the way they attacked that game, process and structure at the ball and behind the ball, Carlton was terrific, Jim.
Well, the thing that stood out to me was that they committed to something, and it must have been spoken about in a team meeting or put on the whiteboard, was target Gary Ablett Jr., the baldy man. But like normally, sometimes sides can put that up and one or two go and do it and then it fades out.
Yeah.
But every single player,
yep,
every time they saw Gary, they bumped into him, whether it was young players who played two or three games or it was Bryce Gibbs, they committed to it, and that single focus can bring a side together, especially on the road.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to ask you this question again that I asked you a couple of weeks ago about Brendan Bolton. How many teams does Brendan Bolton make better if he was coaching them? Because I would say all of them. I would say he would make every other club better.
Well, we've only seen him with a developing list, haven't we? So,
well, we've seen him with Hawthorn.
Well, yes, but they were coaching themselves, those boys, for a little while.
To a point, but he still did coach them.
I can't wait to see him get Carlton to a spot where they're going to be a really good competitor and good contender, and then to see what he does with them too. We've seen this phase of him.
The next layer. Yeah. You're asking for the next layer.
Yeah, and he's been brilliant with what he's done to this point. But when they become a contender, how does he make them be the best?
Yeah.
That's the next challenge for Brendan Bolton, and that can't happen until he gets them there. So that's a long way away. Everything he's doing at the moment is right. But he seems to be a fabulous coach. Nick Flanagan, who has been off the radar a little bit from the PGA perspective for a little while, but it was great to see him back out there in a major tournament at the US Open there in Hills. He's been good enough to join us on The Breakfast Club on RSN 927. G'day, Nick.
How you doing, boys?
We're going really well, mate. Appreciate your time. You have been off the radar for a little while. In fact, I think last year you might have caddied at the US Open for Aaron Price, and this year he caddied for you. And what was it like to be back out there?
Yeah, it was great. It's obviously been a slow few years for me through injuries and a few other things happening away from golf. But it was a great feeling to be back out there playing kind of on the biggest stage in golf again. And hopefully it's a little bit of a stepping stone to keep on moving forward with the career and get back out there more often.
What were your emotions like in the build up to it? Because obviously it's playing in the majors is the epitome. Is why every golfer is out there on tour, to be the best and try and win a major. To be back out there and that first tee, what was that moment like for you?
Yeah, it was surprisingly pretty calm. I was thinking leading into the week that it was going to be a pretty nervous, kind of shaky week for me, but I think my preparation had been great and having a good mate on the bag and stuff like that to keep me relaxed really helped. And I was just planning on being out there and enjoying the time and not trying to put too much pressure on myself. So surprisingly, not as nervous as I probably would have been in the past. So, I felt like I belong out there. It's just a matter of getting out there and playing a few more tournaments.
So, Nick, what's it like, before we go into the actual tournament, but even in the build-up to it on the practice range or practice, can it be intimidating seeing so many of the biggest names in golf around you when you've been off that stage for a little while?
Yes and no. I think probably more or less than maybe it was when I was a little younger. I've gotten to know a bunch of those guys from being out there and, you know, still chat on occasion with a few of them and we'll play in our weeks off. And so it's something that I am a little bit used to, but obviously teeing up in an open is a whole different thing. But, I wouldn't say it's as intimidating as much as it's exciting to be out there with the best players in the world.
And then what about the intimidation of a course like Erin Hills that obviously wasn't as difficult as a lot of people thought because the wind didn't get up, but just the pure length of it? What was it like playing a golf course that's that long?
Yeah, so I guess our practice rounds, it was actually quite windy, probably more like what you're seeing on TV today. And when you play your practice rounds, you tend to tee off the back of the back tees and kind of play it at its full length. So it seemed like it was going to be a really long week teeing up there on Monday and Tuesday in those practice rounds. But they got so many different tee spots out there, they can kind of calm it down a little bit. But they still teed off most of the back tees the first two rounds, and of course it's softened up a little bit, so the greens are a lot easier to kind of navigate. But it's still intimidating when you get up on one of those 520-yard par fives and it's 260 carry to get to certain parts of the fairway. you can't have any miss hits, that's for sure. You end up in that fescue and there's not much fun there. So,
Nick, just on the golf course, do yourself and other Aussies take a bit of confidence when you go to a US Open? They're links styles courses, which a lot of us play on over here.
Yeah, this course especially would have been great if they didn't get that rain, as far as Australians are concerned, because it was going to be super firm and firm and fast around the greens, and you'd be able to hit those run-up shots and, you know, bounce wedges in there 20 feet short and see that one big hop and then be able to check it. But it just didn't end up turning out like that. And, you're backing up 7-irons and 8-irons there in that first round. So I think it would have played into the Aussies' hands a little bit more if it stayed firm.
So what were your expectations, Nick, coming in for this US Open? What were you trying to achieve out of it?
I didn't really have any, to be honest. It was just to be qualifying again and playing well this year in some of the small events I've been playing in and stuff like that has been a huge boost for me. And then my biggest expectation was just to try and be out there and enjoy being out there again and not put too much pressure on myself to perform, because a lot of the time when you really want to play good, that kind of turns out being the biggest fault in actually playing good that week, is because you want it so bad. So just try to stay out of my own way, and I think I did that pretty well. Just had a little bit of a hiccup, you know, on halfway through my second round that kind of completely halted my momentum, and it was just hard to get back on those US Open courses. It only takes 1 or 2 iron shots to go from being well inside the cut line to being, you know, back out to 100.
Good morning to you, Steve-O.
Half boys.
What's your concern with the MRP issue this weekend, Steve-O?
Well, there's a few issues, but I want to ask Jimmy about staging, Jim. Careful, Jim. Acting. It's in the criteria.
Is it?
You can give a warning. Oh. I think if ever you're going to make a warning and a statement, it's been publicised today. I think Johnny Rolfe's written an article as well.
Oh, the buzz.
Just the Lance Franklin push.
Yep.
The push to Rance, and Rance goes back. I think just a little touch-up for Rancey today. A warning.
Really?
Yeah, I think you've just got to stop it, Hart, because it was a free kick that wasn't there. It's going to end up costing.
Well, see, this free kick that wasn't there thing, I'm more than ever angling for free kicks to be paid for stupid things that happen off the ball. Like at the start of the game yesterday, Easton Wood should have given away a free kick to Tom Bug. Ragdolled him, threw him to ground, held him, pay a free kick, and all of a sudden, all that tension, all that heat disappears.
But this was a little push to the chest. Pay went back.
I didn't mind it because they pushed each other, and then Buddy came back for the third time or his second time with a firm one at the neck, the clavicle type area, the collarbone, and he dropped. I don't reckon it was too big an issue. Certainly not a finable drop.
No, you don't.
It wasn't
get fine,
as if he
just
flopped back with the head and the arms and the legs and just...
Isn't it more on the umpire that he shouldn't have given a free kick to Rance for it?
No, but the umpire. It's
but
tough
I don't mind
the,
him paying that
no,
free kick.
No, but it makes it hard for the umpires when Rance does that, when you're a fair way away, really, because he threw himself to the ground.
No, it doesn't.
Because going back to the Hawkins Crouch thing, a lot of people complain the umpire didn't pay anything there. So
that's correct. Yes, good point.
So they pay something now, we complain. They don't pay something, we complain. Mm.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Like Buddy Franklin will get off for the other one. There's no problem there. He's just hit him in the side. We've looked at it a million times. Everybody's looking for some high contact.
Was he reported on match day?
Yeah.
Yes.
That was extraordinary. Why are we reporting players on match day?
That's got to change.
But the umpires are told to report if it's there. It's part of any.
Well, I think they should be told not to. Because the MRP picks up everything. They don't need to worry about it. And if Buddy gets off, he might have been sitting there for the last half of the game going, bloody hell, I've been reported.
It's part of the game.
You know what I reckon should happen? I reckon the umpires should, a little bit similar to the NRL, but the umpires should actually lodge a thing to the match review panel. Say, look, I saw these are the instances I saw on the day that I think you should have a look at. This time of the game, this is the incident, go and have a look at it. And that can be fed straight to the MRP, but doesn't have to
be. But we like the drama of the report, though.
Do we?
We do. They're going back to pulling the guy around. The umpire looking back the number.
Look at his numbers. If you don't know
Buddy's
number.
Bringing the notepad out. Like, we
see if we don't know Buddy's number.
Gives us something to talk about half during the game.
No.
He's been reported.
Well, a lot of times we don't know. And we're just guessing whether or not he's been reported. Because they don't get the notebook out anymore.
I'll throw one at Jimmy.
Okay.
Thursday night. Joel Selwood was involved in an incident, and we're not going to talk about the specific incident because that's unfair on you.
Why not?
Because it's unfair on him, because he's
what's
got to
the
book
of,
it up today.
Well,
you're up and
you
about
talking?
This morning. Well, you're taking your anger out on everyone else.
Be angry with your Bulldogs, mate.
You're taking it hard.
If you're going to talk about the specific incident, what are you going to talk about?
Just let me ask the question. Bulldog fan. Would you like there to be a situation, or is it easy for a situation where you could actually look at the Thursday night game on the Friday rather than wait until the Monday? Is that an easy process for that to be changed?
We'd normally try and get a lot of the decisions done from the Thursday game over the weekend just for the clubs to get back. But sometimes you can't do that because match review panel, they're people who are busy and got things on. So I think all we normally get some footage sent from the Thursday night game, but still then you go over it again on the Monday.
Mm. And going back to a statement you made, which I thought was fantastic, it might have been to a Steve-O question not too long ago. Why the rush? Who cares?
Yeah, who cares?
Gives a great fodder for the weekend.
But just a nail down on the Selwood one.
That Joel Selwood, Luke Shuey situation, Sam Mitchell on the weekend on Thursday night. It's given great content for all of us for the last 3 days. It's
but,
been fantastic.
Just obviously the key to that one will be whether it's intentional or careless, Jimmy.
No, it's not. That might be one thing.
Yep.
And then it's whether he gets him high and
yep.
and whether the impact's low, medium, high.
Yep.
There's a lot of things. There's
insufficient force.
Insufficient force. There's plenty of things.
The Sam Mitchell retaliation has been talked about. I'd be surprised if anything happened there. Luke Shuey's bump on Peter Dangerfield's interesting.
Line ball. I think Selwood will get off because it's just out half when he's falling down. You really can't call that intentional, can you? The speed of the game. He probably did it accidentally on purpose.
Yeah, I think
as I said on Friday. But
Captain Risky.
Yeah, it's still an accident kind of thing.
Oh, he hit him in the back of the neck anyway.
He disguised it.
The back, top of the back.
The neck's still high, though.
No, top of the back.
You know
where they put the letters in the jumper. FFC and
FFC.
SMFC and BBFFC.
I want to ask Steve-O about the match review, not the match review panel, about the Dustin Martin latest, because I know you're quite well connected in this situation. Has the goalpost changed a little bit? Because Brendan Gale came out on ABC Radio on the weekend saying that they're getting a little bit edgy.
Surprising, I thought, from Gale.
I thought it was a real revelation.
He just seemed to say, look, we need to know soon for list management purposes, etc., etc., inferring that in the next week or so, Dusty, just give us an indication of where you're at.
Well, it's not necessarily a week.
But he said we need to know very soon.
I thought it was significant half because I think two things have emerged in the last week, that Dustin Martin is being shopped around by his manager. That's now public.
He's had meetings?
No, he's not shopping around.
Has there been meetings?
Clubs are coming. There has been meetings.
So he's being shopped around?
He's not being shopped around. Clubs are coming to Ralph Carr.
There are other clubs in the frame. How about we just put it that way?
And the other thing is, Brendan Gale, a memo to Brendan. He's waiting till the end of the year. It's not going to happen in the next couple of weeks. He's just going to have to sit back and be patient, unfortunately.
Lightning smacking the Giants 65-48. Was on Channel 9. It was on all the news services. A big competition, and Sharon McMahon was a part of the commentary team and, of course, a big part of our Breakfast Club team. She joins us to go through the game. Good morning, Sherelle.
G'day, Harp, and Whitey and Jimmy in there as well. You say it all went one way, Harp, but the Giants actually, early in the game, got out to a 5-goal lead, and I thought it might go the same way that the prelim did when they absolutely trounced the Vixens. So the Lightning did a good job. They got themselves back in it, and then it went all one way.
They showed all unbelievable resilience, the Lightning. You're right, after that initial scare, I probably should have mentioned that, the initial scare, but I had no fears. Even though it was a 5-goal lead, it didn't look like they were ever really out of touch in the game. It was just the fact that there was a few turnovers and the Giants capitalised. So it was just a matter of cleaning that up, wasn't it?
Yeah, I kind of had that same sense, and I think probably why is because they've got three superstars, Jeeva Mentor in the defence end, Laura Langman in the middle, and Caitlin Bassett in the goal shooting end. But it was the players around them that were, they looked a bit nervous in the beginning, and once they started to just let that settle in, the other players were the ones who really kind of lifted their level. The superstars were always going to be superstars in that moment, and they were. But it was those other players who really stood up. And, gee, they were so good. They were so good.
Sherelle, can you talk us through the significance of the Lightning from a coaching point of view, and also Laura Langman, because there was a real New Zealand influence on this team?
Yeah, definitely. Nolene Tolua was the coach of the Lightning. She actually went for the New Zealand Silver Ferns job just recently when that was up for grabs, and many thought that she would get it. Anyone who speaks about her speaks of her so highly in the way she coaches. So she's certainly someone who's very well respected. But probably the biggest story, as you say, was Laura Langman. By choosing to play in the Australian League with the Sunshine Coast Lightning, she has forfeited her right to represent the Silver Ferns at the upcoming Commonwealth Games. And until she goes back to play for the New Zealand competition, which runs at the same time as the Aussie one. So you've got to choose. And I still can't believe that the Silver Ferns are sticking to their guns on this one. It sounds like they are, but I don't know. I've got a sneaking suspicion that they might flip it over, because there is no way I would leave Laura Langman out of the team. She's one of, if not the best mid-quarters in the world. She's bloody close.
Yeah, I didn't realise it was so significant, the fact that she chose to play in the Australian League, which meant she forego the rights to play for New Zealand. You could see how emotional she was about that after the match.
Yeah, definitely. And I wonder if maybe she thought that they'd overturn that decision. I'm not really sure. I think she's still holding out hope that they will. And as I say, I mean, if it was me in charge, I would want the best players representing my country and my team, and she's certainly in their best. So I would be trying to do something to turn that over.
Well, Sherelle, the first year of the new Super League, how have you seen it and how it's played out?
I think it's been great. I think we've had the five existing teams, the three new franchises. I think from a netball perspective, for me, I think it would have been good to have an existing team in the grand final. Of course, that would have been the Vixens this year, so that would have been nice. But it was the two new teams, and I was surprised a bit, in a way, about how much support that they had kind of gathered behind them. The crowd wasn't quite sold out up in Brisbane, but almost. They were very, very parochial, and the Giants had a similar kind of following. So they kind of gained traction very, very quickly, which was really exciting. And just from a pure netball point of view, the standard is amazing. It's incredibly tough and physical and intense, and there's no doubt that the standard has lifted. And I think it's great seeing our Aussie athletes get more opportunity and play against each other more often.
I always look forward to watching Melbourne play too, because I've got a bit of a fascination.
He's your favourite player.
With this young man who joins us on the program as after their big win over the Bulldogs yesterday. I love the way Jaden Hunt plays across halfback, and he's been good enough to be a part of this discussion. Good morning, Jaden. Well done yesterday.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me in.
It's terrific to have you on board. A big performance from your boys. It was a really important game, for both teams, and there was a bit more spice added pre-game, it seems, with the Tommy Bug Insta post, which caused a bit of a ruckus down at the Bulldogs' place. But it was a bit physical early on. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, no, it was good. We really set ourselves for this game and really put the pressure rating right up there. So, yeah, it was good to get stuck in around the contest early. And, yeah, it was a great start from the boys, and we continued it out throughout the game, which is good.
How does that happen, Jane? You talk about really ramping up the pressure. How does that eventuate or occur? Why doesn't that happen every week?
Oh, it's different teams, I guess. We all know how Bulldogs go around the ball, and if they're given space, they can handball out to their outside runners. So we really try to beat them in the inside with a really hard pressure axe, which is hard to sustain for four quarters, but we really set ourselves the first half, and we're able to keep up the momentum there.
Jaden, this year it looks like you guys are really enjoying your football and really taking the game on in attack more, and I think this is reflective with the way Jack Watts is going with their football. He seems to be up and about and hitting the scoreboard, but just being really brave with the ball use.
Yeah, absolutely. The coaches are really encouraging us to be fearless with our ball movement. If we make mistakes, we make mistakes. But I guess on percentages, we're hitting targets more than we're not. So it's really good. And Watts is brilliant for that, just with his skills. He hardly ever misses, which is really good. And really damaging the scoreboard and helping set up others as well.
And has your coach locked you out of your Instagram account this morning?
Not me. I'm all right at the moment. Buggy, on the other hand, maybe not.
Were you aware, actually, in the rooms that he'd done that? Had he come down and goes, hey, guess what, boys? Just put something out there?
No, I didn't know till after the game. But I think Buggy realised it wasn't probably the smartest move after the game. So, yeah, he probably won't be doing that again.
What sort of feedback did the coaches mention it? Did you get any feedback from the coaching staff? Because I think it's as harmless as just about anything there is in football, to be honest with you, Jaden, to do that sort of thing. And I think he's got a bit of a relationship with JJ, so we're led to believe as well. What did the coach say about it?
Oh, they didn't mention it too much. It's just more just before the game. I think you should just wait and let the actions do the talking, and then kind of assess it rather than just starting off. I guess it's more like the media response to it and everything that kind of make it bigger than it is. So, yeah, it's just an unnecessary thing, I reckon.
Don't worry about the media, mate. They're all useless. but for a guy like Tommy Bug, he seems to me to be a guy that wants to play on the edge and put himself out there to keep himself sharp. Is that a fair assessment of how he plays his footy?
Yeah, I think, yeah, it's just like that white line fever. I think he loves being the pest, so good to have. I guess it's good to have him on your team, but if he wasn't, I guess wouldn't be too much fun having him.
Plenty more opportunities for Nick Newman as well, even though his first nine games have been very, very impressive for the Sydney Swans. They had a fantastic result at the MCG on Saturday against the Tigers, and the young Sydney gun is good enough to join us this morning on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Nick.
G'day, guys. How are you?
Going very well, thanks. I was going to go with the Hello Newman thing, but I reckon you would have heard that a few times.
Yeah, I've heard that and seen that a few times in the last month or so.
Hey, have you found the world of AFL footy? You're a mature age player, picked up in the rookie draft by the Swans, and all of a sudden you're 9 games into an AFL career. How's it all hit you?
Yeah, look, obviously it's been pretty enjoyable. Obviously been there for a couple of years and hadn't got a game, so I was pretty ready this year.
Yep.
But at the same time, it's been really exciting and enjoyable. And plenty of highs and lows in footy. And at the moment, it's going well and playing some good footy and some wins. But yeah, you got to enjoy it while the good times are there.
I just want to ask you on that. You played a lot of NEAFL footy and was dominating at that level. Do you feel that's a chance to really just hone your game and just constantly playing games of football and not being, I guess, managed throughout your career?
Yeah, you're spot on. I think last year was probably my sort of best and most consistent year of footy I've had. And I played every game in the reserves and working pretty closely with Reece Shaw, who's the coach and development coach there. And I think sort of had some things to work on, especially my defensive side of the game. And it was a great opportunity to sort of just chip away at that. And, I think I did that throughout the year and put together some good form and was lucky enough to get an upgrade onto the main list, which obviously is a bit more opportunity to sort of play, especially early in the year. And, it's just been pleasing to put some of that sort of form into the next level.
I just want to know what the Swans do. They seem to be a factory for great small defenders, and you're building on that way. And there's Nick Smith, Dane Rampey, plenty of guys who just play that small defenders role really well. Must be some great guys to learn the position off.
Yeah, you're right. I think led by Nick Smith, he's probably the best we've gotten, best we've had for a while. And I think just the way he goes about it is a credit to him. And if you're sort of coming into the system and want a good person to look at as a small defender, he's up there. And even Reece Shaw, who was a development coach, played that sort of small defender role. So I think, credit to those guys. Those guys put a lot of effort into the young fellas, but I think it's as a whole club. They're really good at developing young guys, and if you're not ready, they won't sort of chuck you in. And I think it's just a credit to the development group that we've got there.
You talked before about chipping away at your career. On the weekend against Richmond, you had to chip away because you get into quarter time and you're 5 goals down. What's the conversation like at that point in the game? Because it was a disappointing start, clearly, but the Tigers were up and about. How did John Longmire handle that situation?
Yeah, look, he wasn't happy, I'll tell you that much. he wasn't happy with how we were going. And I think it was pretty clear to all of us that they were just beating us in pretty much every facet of the game. They were winning their hands on the inside and then getting us on the outside. So for us, it was pretty simple. We just had to go back to winning that contested footy. And then from there, it's about getting the ball forward and trying to change momentum. And I think that's sort of one of the hardest things to do in footy these days. And to be able to sort of stop their momentum and get it back going our way was a credit to our coaching staff and ultimately the playing group.
Let's get to the world famous segment. Who does it say more about? We're going to go through the games on the weekend.
Yeah. Well, the reason I raise this is because we often talk on here that we focus on the loser a lot, but sometimes the opposition can actually play good football.
Yes.
At times. So, hence the question, who does the result say more about? And we go through the games and it's pretty simple how we play this game.
are you a bit nervous about bringing this?
Nah, not at all.
This is your segment, Jim.
Yeah, because I don't really care. I do it anyway. So I'm just making the poor people listen. But West Coast Geelong, it seems like a while ago, almost 2 weeks ago, the Thursday night game, it's sort of been buried a little bit. But Whitey, was it West Coast who brought the intensity and pressure, which they haven't done really all year? Or was it Geelong just not handling it and not really taking the ball forward, sort of panicked with the ball a little bit early?
My view is that it was more about Geelong and its inability to play its best footy away from home. So we criticise West Coast and Adelaide for being bully boys at home. I think Geelong needs to be able to break that tag itself. We kind of know the level we'll get from West Coast at home, and I don't think Geelong was able to lift its level. So I thought it said more about Geelong.
Oh, that was just a bad day for Geelong. I thought it said more about West Coast's inability to win on the road as well. So it was, well, I saw it totally differently, but for the same reason. I thought West Coast at home are always a force, and that's why they need to finish in the top four to give themselves a chance of being a chance for the premiership, because otherwise, even though that's on the road, we know they don't travel too well, otherwise they're no chance.
Well, Jim, what did you think?
Well, I thought it was about West Coast because they brought the heat, which I haven't seen all year, that sort of pressure. I think they do it moments in games, but that was a four-quarter effort. I know it was home, but they ground out a really solid win. But probably the game I think which is this is most apt for is probably Sydney v Richmond. So I thought it said more about the Sydney Swans to me, and I know a lot of people think it's maybe the Tiggies and they've lost another close one after a big lead, but that said more about Sydney's back in a way. They just grounded out a win. We spoke to Nick Newman. You know, Kennedy, he wasn't having the biggest day, but he just kept grinding through. Their young players led them from half back. So Lloyd, Newman, Zach Jones all had really good games. So for me, I think it says a lot about the Swans, and I'd be worried if I was most of the teams in the competition because the Swans are coming.
I flipped on this one. I thought it said more about Richmond because it still hasn't worked out how to improve finishing off games. And to me, it's when they keep the speed in the game half, they're really dangerous. But when they get a lead, they then get cautious. The speed comes out of the game. That allows other teams to come back into it. But I'm a bit like Jimmy, having another think about it. For me, it showed that Sydney have still got the hunger to want to compete and want to be part of this season. Because it could have been pretty easy for them to keel over and say, it's just not our year.
Yep.
But they really dug deep and found a way to get back into the game. And even someone like a Kieran Jack had a big part to play in Sydney getting over the line. So I think it does say a lot more about Sydney.
For me, it was more about Richmond and just watching that last quarter again across the weekend. It was a disaster. It was a dead set disaster. And their inability to make the right decisions when the battle had to be won and there was real heat on them and Sydney coming. I knew Sydney were going to come. That was just what they were going to do. Richmond's inability to cope with the pressure and then some decision-making. There were some classic areas. And I'd love to be in their review today because running down the outside wing a couple of times from half-back through to half-forward, they had extra numbers with the ball carrier in support. Didn't use the extra numbers to try and extend the ground and get them closer to 50 or to launch from 50 for goal. They would kick to a 50-50 coming outside the arc to a bloke who was under pressure. It was just really bad decisions. They did it twice in the last 6 minutes. And when they had a guy riding a shotgun they could have fed the ball to, created the overlap, and the guy who was defending that 50-50 player would have come off them to go to them, which creates the overlap with the 50-50 player, and they're inside 50 without even trying. Just really bad errors decision-wise.
So this is to both of you. The thing that I kept thinking, watching Richmond implode again, was that Damien Hardwick has said publicly, we're concentrating in review, in previous losses where they've had the lead, we're concentrating a lot on what we did right. For 3.5 quarters, we played really well. We're not going to focus too much on the negative. But surely now the time has come where they have to focus on what they're not doing right.
Yeah.
Because it's all very good to say you're playing well for 3 quarters, but when the game's there to be won, they are not doing the right thing at the right time consistently.
Well, I think they've got to understand that every moment is important in the game. And I know we tend to focus on the last 5 minutes with the way Richmond have lost their games. But in two of those losses, particularly the GWS game and the one on the weekend, they had 3 or 4 shots early in the last quarter. That completely changes the way the game's being played. So even if you kick 2 of those, you've got that buffer and margin in the game. You can set up defensively a bit better. You can roll a number back from the wing. You know, you can do all sorts of things. But if you understand as a Richmond player that the moments in the third quarter and early in the last quarter, and even if you go back to the second quarter, have just as much importance on the result as those last 5 minutes, you actually don't really get yourselves in those situations.
I understand 100% with what you're saying. But isn't it also that Richmond do change the way they play when they've got a lead and they start to preserve it?
Well, I reckon they played a bit quick in the last bit. to be honest with you. The last 10 minutes, I reckon they played a bit quick. And
Jim was that when they were panicking, though?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. They played a bit quick, and Sydney put their numbers back. They did man up Sam Reid in the forward, in the defensive area.
It took about 13 marks, line, Sam Reid.
Which was unbelievable. Got to man him up. At least play someone in front of him and make him accountable or make a decision. They played too quick and too frenetically without any composure, and that was the issue for the Tigers. And I dispute they played well for three quarters. They played well for a quarter and a half.
Yeah,
in that game on Saturday. So it said more about Richmond.
I don't know. It's when they get the lead, it's brought about by really offensive footy, attacking footy, and they set themselves up really. But then they get this lead and they start getting passive.
Who does say more about Friday night, the worst game of football I've seen in a decade, St Kilda and North? Jim?
St Kilda for me. That was one that they had to win, and they did it. A number of players weren't playing their best footy. Jack Stephen was well tagged. He pushed forward, kicked a couple of goals, which sort of broke the back of North Melbourne, I think. So, Saints for mine.
Yes, it was all on St Kilda. They needed to win that to pretty much keep their season going. And I think they've found their level. They're an 8-12 team, and North Melbourne's probably a 12-14 team.
Gee, they need some class, the Saints, if they're going to contend.
No, that's a good point.
Port Adelaide, Brisbane, who does it say more about? Good fight up until half time, and then the Port Adelaide boys ran over the top of them, Jim?
Oh, I think it said more about Brisbane. I think their younger players have got a bit more talent than we think. They're coming along really well. They're believing in what Fagan's doing up there. Dane Zorko is a superstar. I think we should start acknowledging that. He's averaging 27 possessions and kicked 18 goals already this year. So, Brisbane for me.
I'm with you. The system that they're building and the culture they're building up there at Brisbane seems to be paying dividends, and it's going to take some time, but they showed plenty in that first half, and they got overrun, which you expect from that level of or demographic of players against Port Adelaide away. But I was really impressed with Brisbane.
The predictable nature was that Port Adelaide win that by 15 goals, and you go, yeah, that's about right. A lot of Brisbane's good players, apart from Zorko, didn't play particularly well. Tom Rockliffe had very little impact on the game, a couple of the others, but they still stayed in the contest.
Carlton and Brisbane Saturday night was an absolute... Gold Coast Saturday night was an absolute cracker. Who does it say more about, Jim?
Carlton for me. They're maturing along really well, and Bryce Gibbs, that was an extraordinary performance from him.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, 43, 10 tackles, couple of goals, but going into state as a young side or a side maturing is normally where you see the drop off. But they, like I said, they had a clear focus and they kept it really simple. It was target the baldy man, and they went after Gazza, and they played a real hard edge to their game.
Said more about Carlton because they backed up a good performance with another good one.
I tend to agree. Although I did quite like Gold Coast's ability to come back into that game. They were nowhere in the first half, and their ability to come back. And they probably should have won it, as I said before, that had that sad injury not happened to Michael Barlow, where they lost all momentum when Gold Coast hit the front. I reckon they would have won that game, the Gold Coast. But so a little bit went in their favour, but they earned the right with the work they put in. Melbourne and Western Bulldogs. Yesterday we've spoken a bit about this. Who did it say more about Whitey?
Melbourne. I think they're the real deal.
Jim?
Yeah, Melbourne, because you'd expect those Bulldogs, what do you call it, the line in the sand where they were going to make a big statement. I think most people thought that, and Melbourne still without their number one key forward, their number one ruck, and a few sore boys from the Queen's birthday weekend. They played, again, to use that word, they played with the real edge. You know, Tom Bugg started it on social media, but they backed it up.
They did. I'm with you. I said more about Melbourne and where they're headed rather than the Bulldogs, which I think are just peddling at the moment. That was the best of the Breakfast Club from this morning. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.